Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
At the moment, I think reached a point where North Dakotans accept it, believe in it, use it, and look to it for help in troubled times especially, but also in good times, because it's become a major force in the economic development of the state. The conclusion has to be that despite the ups and downs and the opposition that's occurred from time to time, the bank has come to be not just accepted, but thought of as a critical part of the state's business and financial structure.
That's the Bank of North Dakota's centennial historian, Mike Jacobs, with whom we will share a relaxed and extended visit today from his chilly perch on the prairie as we wrap up our review of the bank's 100 years celebration. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, senior advisor to the Public Banking Institute and Ellen's co-host. It's the end of a remarkable year for public banking generally, with new and substantial initiatives underway in California and New Jersey, which promise to make 2020 an even more exciting year for these initiatives. Listening to Mike Jacobs share his recollections of the many, many stories that express the stresses and successes of the Bank of North Dakota gives the process of creating new public banks some context as to process and the issues which the BND, as we like to refer to it, has had to traverse. Some of these lessons are being learned and addressed even now as these new banking initiatives move forward. Mike is a former newspaper editor and reporter and has seen firsthand how the bank and its sponsors have behaved through trials and tribulations. We think you'll enjoy this very relaxed visit with Mike. But first, we want to visit with Ellen, whose latest article touches on another historical figure, one more centrally connected to us all through the Federal Reserve.
Your article this past week about Paul Volcker talks about a different era of economics and monetarization of our economy, a whole different era of shift that he represented with his passing at the age of 92. You say at the end of your article that he was probably a nice guy, well-meaning, lived frugally, but that his a couple of ways of looking at his contribution.
It's hard to tell whether different people have said he was personable, more so than any other Fed head. And then there was the fact that apparently he had used wooden crates or something for his lunchroom table. I mean, he was very frugally. And so he's not in it for the money. So what was he in it for? There is the fact that he was basically a Rockefeller agent for his whole career. I mean, that's how he got into it. And he was in the CFR and the Bilderbergers, et cetera. So who knows? But particularly if somebody has just passed, you don't want to be too critical. But whatever his real motive was, he was credited by Alan Greenspan, for example, with being the most effective chairman in the history of the Federal Reserve, which he probably was. He did reinstate the credibility of the Fed at a time when it had lost its credibility, but on false grounds. So what he did, basically, that he's famous for, that everybody knows, was that he drove interest rates up to 20% in the early 1980s, supposedly to cure stagflation. And stagflation did reverse. And so everybody credits that with these very high interest rates. But in fact, as I showed, and as William Engdahl has showed, and other writers, I cited different writers, he showed that oil went exactly tracked the inflation rate, and oil is inextricably combined with all sorts of products. So if the price of oil goes up, plastics, all sorts of things go up. So it just makes costs go up. And so that drove prices up. And the reason oil went up was that after the dollar was taken off the gold standard in 1971 by Nixon, it was crashing. And in order to prop it back up, apparently, this is according to William Engdahl, Nixon and Henry Kissinger, who was also a David Rockefeller person, you know, in that whole group, they met with the Shah of Iran in, I think it was 1973. And then right after that, a group met in Europe and came up with this plan where the OPEC countries would sell their oil only in U.S. dollars and they would put the dollars in U.S. banks. And in return, Kissinger said, we are going to make you very rich. We're going to quadruple the price of oil. And also they got military protection. So that the price of oil was quadrupled with that 9 days war, or was it 11 days? Anyway, a very short war with Israeli war in the Middle East. And that drove up the price of oil. And then that drove up the price of everything else. And then in 1979, there was the Iran Revolution. And that again drove up the price of oil. It actually doubled. It had gone up by a factor of four. And then it was doubled beyond that. So the price of oil was way, way up there. And that drove the price of everything else up. So, and then it dropped suddenly in the early 1980s. And Paul Volcker got the credit for these very high interest rates. But in fact, what the very high interest rates did was basically got rid of the unions, broke the middle class, broke the savings and loans, set up this whole system where banks securitized their mortgages and sold them off to investors, and set up the framework for liberalizing the laws so that then we had derivatives, which were supposedly to protect the investors because, you know, of all the how risky things were. And so derivatives and other speculative things, and that this led to the 2008 crash and then quantitative easing, et cetera. So the Fed has been instated as the control mechanism for our economy, and you could trace that back to Paul Volcker's actions. And also, he was apparently the trigger for taking gold off the gold standard. There was in 1971, he persuaded Nixon to do it, apparently at the behest of Rockefeller, who was his earlier employer. So anyway, it's very controversial what his role was and whether he was conscious, you know, whether he was intentionally destroying the economy for the benefit of the big banks, the Wall Street banks, or whether he was, you know, very innocently, or whether he realized that the things he had done wrong and was trying to correct them. We know he was responsible for the Volcker Rule in, I think, 2010, which was an effort to once again separate depository banking from investment banking. So anyway, he's a very controversial figure. But what's interesting to me is the fact that through that whole 1980s thing, economic policy was set up that we've been following ever since, that the number one goal of the central bank is to control inflation, that inflation is caused by too much money in the system, and that the way you control that is to drive up interest rates, that will prevent people won't lend as or won't borrow as much, and therefore they won't spend as much, and that's supposed to contract the deflate the money supply. But that's not the way it works. If you increase interest rates, producers have fixed costs and they will have to just borrow at the higher rates, which means they will raise their prices. And you can show that historically, that prices go up, not down. So that was kind of an outlier, that 1980s thing, and it was due to something else. So anyway, we've got a very skewed economic system based on false premises, and we need to change that. And that's why I write about such things in hopes of, you know, shedding some light on what's really going on here. And we need more money in the system. And the debt problem is because people don't have enough money to pay off their debts. And it would not cause inflation to give them, for example, a university basic income or add some money to their real economy, the real productive economy, as opposed to the speculative economy.
So Paul Volcker's history is a mixed bag of reviews that he was singularly credited with, or maybe charged with getting us off of the gold standard, which was constraining the size of our monetary system to deal with expanding trade needs.
Yeah.
but then handing it over to a political stratagem which pegged our monetary system to the oil cartels that the global banks were all involved with. So Volcker was really an agent to make that happen.
Yeah, so all very interesting. And the whole theory is interesting. The fact that the whole, it's called neoliberal, but you could call that a misnomer too. It makes it sound like it's liberal, which is left, but it's really not. It's more like right on the right-hand side. So anyway, that whole economic theory is wrong, and that we've got to get off that horse and get on what works better.
Let's get into the conversation with Mike Jacobs, who is sitting out on the prairie in North Dakota at a couple of degrees, looking back at his centennial recollection and how that bank has managed to get so far and succeed so brilliantly.
Bank of North Dakota is a unique model. It's the only such model that we have, and it's been worked brilliantly well.
I wish you and all of our listeners a happy holiday season. We'll look forward to what happens in 2020. It should be a really exciting year.
Great.
Thanks, Ellen.
Thanks, Bob.
As we've just noted, 2019 was a pretty good year for public banking in terms of the new legal and political developments around the country. But it was also the year of a significant historical achievement for public banking in America, the 100th anniversary of the Bank of North Dakota. We've talked about that several times during the year to give you a sense of where this lone bank on the prairie came from, politically, socially, and economically. But the impact of reporting that America's only public bank is not only one of its most profitable and well-run, but it's also 100 years old. They've been operating it successfully for that long, meaning that its democratic foundation has created a legacy institution that has served the people through thick and thin. No wonder others want to replicate it. Well, today, this being our last program for the year, we want to do a bit of final retrospective with the author and historian of the Bank of North Dakota's centennial celebration, Mike Jacobs, who is the editor of the Grand Forks Herald in North Dakota. In previous visits with us on this program, Mike took us behind the scenes of how the bank was getting formulated, and in some cases undermined, by its initial forebears. Mike's wealth of knowledge about the bank and North Dakota is deep and local. And since most of you don't live on that Midwestern prairie, nor have had the pleasure of relaxing in pleasant conversation with one of its locals, we invite you to just get a cup of coffee and sit down for a leisurely visit with us with Mike, a now retired editor with a charming way of describing events and people. It was a sunny but cold single-digit Fahrenheit morning when we spoke. This will finish our historical series on the bank with Mike, and the remainder of this program, so get comfortable and listen in as Mike wraps up this look back at the 100 years of the Bank of North Dakota.
The centennial celebration back in July was quite an event. We spoke a bit about it then. Everybody involved with the bank, state officials involved with the bank, that is the Industrial Commission, the governor, the attorney general, the agriculture commissioner, the bank president, all of them spoke about the bank and its role in the state. I think the takeaway is that it's an institution that that has served the state fairly well. I mean, there have been tough times and good times, but at the moment, it's I think reached a point where North Dakotans accept it, believe in it, use it, and look to it for help in troubled times, especially, but also in good times, because it's become a major force in the economic development of the state, which of course was the intent of the founders. In fact, it's in the mission statement of the bank that creating a cash supply, basically a ready source of credit to develop the state's resources, is a function of the bank in the original charter. So I think that the conclusion has to be that despite the ups and downs and the opposition that's occurred from time to time, the bank has come to be not just accepted but thought of as a critical part of the state's business and financial structure.
And of course, we've talked about several of the confrontations, historical events and developments at the start of the bank. One of the things that other people who are looking at public banks always ask about is the accountability, the reliability, really the controversy that can occur. And the bank was not without controversy at times.
No, not at all.
What were some of the ones that were really formulative and
most well, notable? The initial launch of the bank was accompanied by bitter resistance, including a challenge to its constitutionality, which the U.S. Supreme Court dismissed, saying basically, if the state sees fit to form a bank and it's done democratically, there's nothing that the court, there's no business of the court in interfering. So that was an important first challenge. Of course, there were nevertheless political challenges. The bank survived both twice on the ballot, once in a referral, and then once in an effort to initiate a measure that would eliminate all of the league program, the nonpartisan league programs. Both of those were defeated. The latter on the very day that the league officials themselves were recalled from office. So that election, I think, was critical. It happened on the 21st of November in 1921, of October, I'm sorry, the 21st of October in the 29th of October in 1921. And at that election, the bank and the Millen Elevator and the other programs of the league were upheld, but the Industrial Commission was recalled. So the message, I think, that the incoming administration, led by more conservative Republicans, was we're gonna make this thing work. They did in a very limited way. Initially, the bank was quite cramped in what it was able to do, but over the years, it's come to be seen as an ever-present source of help in times of trouble, you might say.
Yeah. The Industrial Commission is only three people.
Right, the governor, the attorney general, and the agriculture commissioner. There was great controversy about this. I've always referred to them as the ideologues, the hardcore public ownership socialist, for lack of a better term. Well, it is an accurate term. People in the league movement very much wanted to have an independent board that didn't answer to the political structure for the bank and the other industries. But William Lemke, the attorney general, who succeeded Langer, that's why I always get them confused. Lemke wrote the legislation and insisted on an elected board of directors, so that there would never be the concern that you couldn't take immediate action to temper whatever the bank had done. So that has proven to be, in hindsight, I think, an inspired decision. Because a bank with a board that was not overseen by people that voters could get at directly would have been I think a lot easier to attack and also probably a lot less responsive to public opinion and more important than that to changes in the financial situation in the state. You know, an elected board is pretty conscious of the people who elected them and listen pretty closely to what might be needed and what might be accepted. So I my own judgment, and this is not universally shared, I think, even among people who have studied the bank history, but my own conclusion is that was a decision that probably saved the bank because it essentially allowed the stockholders in the bank, that is the voters of the state, to fire the management and bring in new management while continuing the institution along a path that its founders had and the voters had approved.
But that would have happened at an election, yes?
Right.
Yeah, so every 4 years.
Initially, all of the officers, all of the Industrial Commission members were elected every 2 years. And it wasn't until 1964 that we went to four-year terms. And then somewhat later than that, the ballot was split so that now the governor is elected in presidential years, and I believe also the agriculture commissioner, and then the attorney general is elected in the so-called off year, so that there is some rotation, some overlap now that didn't exist before. And that has resulted, frankly, in a more politically diverse board because it allows for change. While you maintain some of the members, you are able to change others, and that has happened. And the bank has been the object of some campaigns for change. I think particularly of the election following the Hunter and Potato Bowl, which which is described in the. In the book, that resulted in the election of a new agriculture commissioner, while the other two officers continued, and it happened again in 2000 when there was controversy about Joe Lamb, the president of the Sinner administration, had a very tight credit policy. In some sense, attempting to recover from what had happened with some of the looser policies of the previous administration. But there was a campaign against that policy in the 2000 election, and that resulted in a change as well. So there's never been a campaign to abolish the bank since a public campaign, that is, on the ballot or in the gubernatorial or in statewide elections, since 1921, there have been efforts in the legislature to make changes. The most important of them, I believe it was the 1975 session, when conservative legislators imposed an advisory board made up of largely of private bankers. And initially, the bank, at that time run by Herb Thorndahl and Governor William Guy, resisted that. But in the end, it came to be a recognized part of the bank. This group of private bankers essentially reviews the largest, I think, loan applications of more than $15 million, I think is the current policy, are reviewed, and the private bankers make recommendations about the creditworthiness of the loan, about the risk involved in the loan. To my knowledge, there have been no controversies that have arisen, at least in the recent past, between the advisory board and the management of the bank.
Is there any citizen representation aside from the banking interests who are on the advisory board? Are citizens of various backgrounds also included on the advisory board?
I would have to do some quick research to tell you the definitive answer to that question. I believe that the idea is that the citizens are represented by the political officers who are elected.
The advisory board then approves large loans above $15 million.
It makes recommendations. It has no executive authority. It is an advisory board only. So the bank could go ahead and make loans that the advisory committee advised against.
And the ultimate say is by the Industrial Commission.
Three
members.
Yes.
There has been a point where the three of them weren't able to come up with an agreement because the governor, who sat on the board, vetoed some of the intentions.
Yes, this is another interesting side point in the history of the bank. The Industrial Commission cannot take action without the governor. In other words, the governor has no veto authority at this point, but if he's not there, they can't take action. So it's a sort of a closet veto, so to speak. If he leaves the room, they can't take action. And that has happened on occasion. Normally, it's because there's some disagreement or some desire to get more detail about a specific loan. To my knowledge, that is very rare. Both of those circumstances actually are rare. That a loan that was not recommended by the advisory committee would be approved, and that one that got as far as the Industrial Commission itself would not eventually be approved. The commission might impose terms that the advisory committee didn't recommend, or vice versa, the advisory committee might recommend terms that the bank itself, the management of the bank, which presents the loan, of course, had not considered.
So you described the electoral process, if I understand correctly, every 2 years, one of the three members is up for election.
In presidential years, two of the three members are up for election. In off years, one of them is up for election.
And do people, how often is it that people who are running for these positions refer to bank issues?
It's rare. It does happen. It happened, as I mentioned, this is coincidental, I think. It happened at the beginning of the Sinner administration when the incoming Democrats were critical of the loan policy, which they considered to be too generous, the specific loan that was pointed to was the loan to the Honduran potato dealer. Earlier than that, at the end of the Link administration, which would have been 1980, the very late 1970s, there was a scandal at the bank involving trading in public bonds, and Alan Olson, who was at the time the Attorney General, made an issue of it in the 1980 election. That late 1970s era was a time when the bank got a lot of attention. There was an investigation in 1973-75 that led to the Advisory Commission, and then there were a couple of embarrassing called pretending to be an agent of a privately owned bank in Mandan across the river from Bismarck, and the bank has always acted as a correspondent bank for local banks, and they needed cash, and so this guy came into the bank and the bank gave him the cash on the authority of the phone call, which is sloppy practice, you have to I think concede, and the guy left town and never was caught. He got away with five figures, not low five figures, I think, in the
wow.
end, and then. Not coincidentally, but in the same general time frame, there was a scandal involving a bond trader, which the details of it were really salacious at the time. It involved a confrontation at the political watering hole in Bismarck, with various people yelling at each other in public. But in the end, there was a conviction. So that set the stage then for the 1980 election, which was a Republican sweep. And there was a keen interest in making some kind of big splash with the bank, And I think that that the sort of official history is that they just were too enthusiastic, and so that there were a number of bad loans made. The Honduran potato bowl was not, potato deal was not the only one, and so the Sinner administration came in. Democrats now came in, elected in 1984, and took a majority of the seats on the commission. George Sinner brought in Joe Lamb, who was the president of the smallest private bank in the state, and a real credit hawk. He really tightened up the credit policies of the bank, to the consternation of other Democratic state officials who were unable to, they were bringing forward some of the co-ops, which at the time were very strongly aligned with the Democratic Party, were bringing forward loans that the Industrial Commission, through Joe Lamb, was rejecting. So the compromise, so to speak, was to bring in John Hoven, who was the president of a private bank in Minot, a larger bank, one of the larger banks in the state at the time. And he, I think the way to put this is that he regularized the credit policies of the bank, making them more in line with what commercial banks were doing, establishing more understandable as well as more approachable and more lenient, shall we say, credit terms. He wasn't the kind of hawk that Joe Lamb had been. On the other hand, of course, Joe Lamb faced a completely different kind of crisis. He had a bank that was short on capital that he needed to somehow revitalize. 8 years later, the situation had moderated to a considerable degree, and so it was possible to begin the kind of economic development lending that Sinner and his successors have made a hallmark of the bank.
And that really was a dividing point in the success of the bank, wasn't it? When it went from mostly mortgage financing, which
right.
was underwritten by federal guarantees, and
right.
moved into the economic development sector,
right, and of course that was a hazardous transition because obviously some of the initial economic development loans, ag loans particularly, didn't work out very well. I mentioned them earlier, and of course there again, the potato loan is the exhibit A, so to speak. So the bank had a bit of a wobbly time as it tried to transition from what had been a very conservatively run bank to a bank that really wanted to try to fulfill the mission statement that the founders of the bank had set out, which was to be a source of credit to develop the state's natural resources.
Right, and agriculture, of course, being critical to the economy of North Dakota since
right,
the start of the
yeah.
20th. But then ultimately the bank pulled out of the agriculture sector for a good while, didn't it?
Pulled out is probably too strong a term. Following the potato debacle, there was a contraction in loans generally, but there were still some that were being advanced, particularly to agricultural processing operations, cooperatives mostly, not exclusively, but largely. But loans to private farm owners really wasn't an important part of the bank's portfolio during that stretch of time. So you can say it pulled out of agriculture, but it didn't really pull out of the business of agriculture. I mean, the approach was different. Then, of course, there's been a very active effort to develop farm loan programs, especially in two specific areas. One is beginning farmers, and the other is disaster loans, loans that essentially breach bad harvests, which frankly is going to be a very important portfolio for the bank going into 2020. This has been one of the one of the toughest agricultural seasons since the 1930s in North Dakota, for exactly the opposite reason. It's just too damn wet. And of course, in the 30s, it was the opposite. But there's still hundreds of thousands of acres of corn, especially, that has not been harvested and won't be harvested almost certainly until spring.
So the economic development component of the bank's portfolio that finally settled in and started to produce consistent results, brought about by, as you say, a banker, at the time the president of the bank, was somebody who had banking background. It sounds like, it seems like professional bankers were very important throughout the history of the bank's development to put it on a firmer footing.
Right. It never pretended to be anything other than a bank. And, you know, banks depend on a return. And so the Bank of North Dakota has always been interested in being a solvent. So,
right. I'm mindful of the bank's current president, Eric Hartmeier, who said in a conversation, he said, if you're going to start one of these banks, make sure that you put a banker in charge of making the loans. Don't give it to your development people. They've never seen a loan they don't like.
Right, yes, yes. And
instructive. Well, with that sort of professional backdrop, the community bankers have kind of rallied around and felt more confident of the bank in the last several decades?
Yes, certainly so. I think that that really began when there are two important developments. One is Joe Lamb's insistence that loans were going to have to be solid. They had to be low-risk loans, basically, in order for him to approve them. The other was that the Sinner administration redefined the way that economic development loans were going to be made and required it began to share in the risk of loans that private banks were being made. It would buy portions of the loan, for lack of a better term. And it insisted that local governments provide some security through bonding for these loans. So rather than having a single risk lender, you had a three-legged stool, so to speak, sharing the risk. There was the And this had maybe two or three important implications. One was that it made the local government and local taxpayers, it gave them ownership in a sense of the enterprise. It allowed local banks to vastly expand their credit ability, their lending limits, because they could bring the Bank of North Dakota in to augment their lending ability. You know, North Dakota has a lot of small banks that don't have a lot of lending capacity, and that was even more true when the bank was initially chartered. And then, of course, it gave access to it's not an unlimited fountain of money, but there's a lot of cash sitting in the Bank of North Dakota from various sources, and so it gave local governments, local businesses, and local banks access to a pool of capital that they would never have had without the establishment of the bank.
We're talking with Mike Jacobs, the retired editor of the Grand Forks Herald and author of the Bank of North Dakota's centennial book called The Bank of North Dakota, From Surviving to Thriving, The First 100 Years. The book is available on the Bank of North Dakota website. The growing interest in this phenomenal prairie institution makes Mike's recollections and insights into how it has managed to survive instructive for those of us who want to replicate that success. One aspect of the Bank of North Dakota uniquely brings to the state its own virtual central bank.
Some people make the analogy of the Bank of North Dakota as being your own local Federal Reserve.
And in fact, the founders of the bank sort of envisioned it that way. They certainly wanted to have a correspondent bank, especially in North Dakota, because virtually all of the money was being sent to Minneapolis. All of the transactions were being done through Twin Cities banks, and of course there were fees and discounts and all of that involved. So the founders of the bank definitely wanted to have a pool of funds, and in fact they required initially a deposit of all public funds in the Bank of North Dakota. That was extremely controversial and remained so until the bank began to allow, or the law was changed to allow local governments to deposit their revenues, tax revenues, in private banks. And that did a lot to lessen the opposition among private bankers to the existence of the Bank of North Dakota.
Are they still uniformly supportive of the bank, or do they still feel in a competitive disadvantage somehow with BND?
My observation is that the only bankers, the only private bankers who are not supportive of the Bank of North Dakota are the new managers in Twin Cities branch banks. And they quickly learn that they're coming in from outside the state. And they quickly learn that their business is allied, not dependent, of course, on the Bank of North Dakota, but closely allied with the Bank of North Dakota. So there aren't many seasoned private bankers in the state who are, some of them are ideologically critical. I mean, they think that this shouldn't be the case, but since it is the case, they're more than willing to use it.
You've talked about the events that have come up in life, the changing weather and changing agricultural fortunes, but we have changing demographics a little bit. But then you have a changing economic tsunami, which was the fossil fuel development.
Yes.
How did the bank relate to that, and how does it relate to it now?
Well, initially, of course, the bank actually owned an enormous number of mineral acres, because one of the things that the Langer administration did in the 30s and 40s, it was carried on into the 40s, was to keep mineral acres on land that it had loaned against during the Depression, and so the bank came into possession of a lot of mineral deed titles. Those have since been transferred to the state land board. But the initial oil boom in the initial beginning of oil production in North Dakota in 1951, the Bank of North Dakota actually sold leases or leased land. There were auction sales for leasing rights. So it was getting revenue in that way from mineral development. The way it gets money from mineral development now is through the deposits of the state, which the state's money is deposited in the Bank of North Dakota, and the state takes 10% of the wellhead price of every barrel of oil. So that amounts to, and we're pumping 1.5 million barrels a day, according to the latest estimate. So you can do the math. If oil is, I didn't look this morning, but around $50. You're getting $5 a barrel. It doesn't take long to have a whole lot of money, and so that has really helped the bank in many ways. It built an enormous new building that just sort of speaks of success, and it started a whole bunch of programs that basically reduced the debt load, and particularly the interest owed on student loans, and through consolidation of student loans, and similarly with with industrial and agricultural loans. It started these these programs for beginning farmers, various kinds of relief programs. So, the state, there are people in the state in North Dakota who would dispute this, but North Dakota is awash in cash. It is very conservative about spending the cash, both in its loan policies and its government financing policies. But nevertheless, there's a lot of money abroad at the moment. The bank is not dependent on oil revenue. It makes a profit off of its operation. So it would continue to operate even if it didn't have this very large fund of money that was earning interest that's being banked in the Bank of North Dakota.
Any thoughts that as the fossil fuel frontier changes in the face of a number of other issues, moving into different technologies and so forth, that there will be an overbuilt sort of a condition in which the bank will have to somehow eat some of its investment? Is that at all on the horizon, do you think?
Well, I'm speaking editorially now. North Dakota's economy is at considerable risk from climate change, whatever the cause. And the climate change makes agriculture significantly riskier. And that was proven, I think, beyond a doubt in the extremely wet conditions that prevailed in North Dakota this year. And we have been getting consistently wetter for a quarter century, about, and we have been getting consistently warmer. And as a consequence, the kinds of crops that are being grown have changed, which is probably on balance economically a good thing, perhaps not environmentally, but economically a good thing, except that the risk has grown exponentially. We're having later planting seasons. The winters are spring comes later, and we're having wetter harvest seasons, partly because the temperatures in the fall are warmer than they have in the past been, and consequently you get rain instead of snow, which is a problem. I mean, we had record rainfall in much of North Dakota. I think that, if I remember right, 49 of the 53 counties have gotten federal disaster declarations for agricultural damage. So global warming is a threat to production agriculture. At the same time, recovering or mitigating global warming through regulation or through moving to other energy sources is a threat to North Dakota's economy because it depends so heavily on fossil fuel taxes, particularly oil. And so we've got a two-headed snake here, and it's critically important for North Dakota to figure out how it can manage the agricultural risks while absorbing the changes that are coming in fossil fuel industries.
Is there anybody at the bank that's tasked with that sort of forward visioning?
I think that the concentration at the moment is on is in the research facilities at the two universities, the two research universities, which are seeking funding for a fairly vigorous, a fairly robust research program that will address these issues. The Energy and Environmental Research Center at UND has got an array of programs that are looking at how to reduce the carbon output while continuing to produce oil and gas. So, they're looking at carbon sequestration. They're looking at returning carbon, pumping carbon back into the ground. They're looking at a whole range of production techniques that could potentially mitigate carbon. The potential advantage, if there is one, is that, of course, oil is used broadly beyond energy. And so there's quite a bit of interest in alternate uses of oil, and particularly of natural gas, which is largely, well, I shouldn't say largely, a disturbingly large amount of it, somewhere between 15 and 20% is currently being flared. So that's an immediate production of greenhouse gases at the wellhead. And so there's a vigorous effort to find ways to put that natural gas to use. I mean, of course, the problem is that the United States has more natural gas than it knows what to do with, and so it's burning it, not just in North Dakota, but elsewhere as well. So that's a critical research focus. That's something that's happening at the University of North Dakota, which is in Grand Forks, where I happen to be. At NDSU in Fargo, there's a solid concentration on alternate crops and on alternate ways to grow crops, ways that will mitigate the vagaries in climate. You know, for many, many years, NDSU has been concentrated on crops that will produce in a short growing season. You know, it used to be that corn was not a viable crop in North Dakota because it had a longer growing season. But now, North Dakota is a fairly important corn-producing state. Of course, a lot of that corn is being produced for ethanol. So, you know, there are critical political and research questions that arise there as well. So, at the moment, the universities are developing a program that they're going to take to the state legislature, asking for funding for a fairly broad research program. I don't know what all is included. I don't know that anybody knows at this point what all is included. But the research vice presidents at each of the two research universities have been meeting for several months to come up with something. A program was rejected in the, it wasn't rejected, it was funded at a relatively small level in 2019. So they're looking ahead now to the 2021 legislative session, and they're going to be doing, as I understand it, a fairly broad political campaign to get the legislature to fund it, and then that, of course, will be money that will be doled out through the bank and the various state institutions involved. It's a heavy political lift, I have to say, because you know there are climate deniers. There are fiscal conservatives. You know, there are climate deniers who don't accept that this is in any way something we need to deal with. And then there are fiscal conservatives who are, some of them, willing to say, well, there's something going on, but they're very conservative about spending. So it's a heavy lift in a conservative, you know, particularly a fiscally conservative state like this.
So you've described in the past 100 years of the bank being present for all of these changes, economic, political, social, mm-hmm. agricultural, that the bank has been witness to and actively engaged in. And here we are 100 years later, and the world has changed in a lot of ways, and you guys have a bank. And you become the focus really around the United States of doing a great job of integrating public will, political will, going through the motions of confrontations and disagreements and so mm-hmm. forth, and still coming on with a successful portfolio that has lifted your state into really the excellence, an unmatched excellence in terms of its fiscal stability and potential and capability. So certainly I'm not one who can speak for everybody, but for everybody who is in this public banking movement, we certainly share the celebration and the good mm-hmm. the good fortune and appreciate what you've accomplished. When you look back at the first 100 years, your book, your really excellent book, Mike, The Bank of North Dakota, From Surviving to Thriving, the first 100 years, how would you characterize the first 100 years, and what would you have to say about the next 100?
The first 100 years were tough, particularly the first 75 years. You know, the real success of the bank goes back, the first 60 years were really tough. The bank really turned a corner toward the 1970s into the 1980s, and particularly into the 90s and 2000s. And it was buoyed, of course, by a much stronger economy than the state had enjoyed in the teens, and particularly in the 20s and 30s. But the stronger economy owes something to the presence of the bank, because as a producing economy, an economy that's heavily dependent on commodities, in some senses a colonial economy, you know, the issue of finding a way to handle your money, it's almost always the first challenge that a developing economy faces, and so we are no longer that. We're no longer in that position. You know, we're now a strong, functioning economy with institutions that serve us well, but we do have some very important challenges, and those challenges are going to cost both time, effort, and money to address. And I think that the generation that follows mine, that's now, I'm retired. The generation that's now making these decisions has got what probably amounts to a more difficult set of issues than the founders of the bank and the people that built the bank during my lifetime faced. So I look back and I say, we did, you know, we're proud of the bank and what it's been able to accomplish, and we're pretty confident that people with the same kind of commitment to the state and the same kind of understanding of how the bank can be used to stabilize and to build the economy will be able to meet these challenges. But I'm not a prophet. I'm a reporter.
and a good one, Mike. Thank you so very much for your very full and colorful description of some of these eras that you've all lived through, and your insight has been very much appreciated.
Every time I think about this, it scares me to say that I have lived through 2/3 of the state's history. you know, the bank, as you've noted, is solid and well established. There's been no real legislative moves against it for quite some time. So I think that North Dakotans have come to understand and appreciate its role. That's not to say, of course, that there won't be changes in political attitudes, but I don't see something happening that would undercut the bank's central role in North Dakota's economy.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mike, for your contribution here. We will be in touch. I'm looking forward to speaking with you again along the way, and certainly have a wonderful holiday.
Yeah, and you too.
All right, Mike. Thank you once again. Enjoy and take good care.
Yep, you too. Yep. Thanks so much.
That's Mike Jacobs, official historian for the Bank of North Dakota's 100th anniversary and author of the retrospective volume, The Bank of North Dakota, From Surviving to Thriving, The First 100 Years, which is available from the Bank of North Dakota website and through local and online booksellers. Best wishes to you for the holidays ahead, and we look forward to the new year to come. It should be exciting for public banking pioneers. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Money!